The Bakken oil boom took off one decade ago. Tall rigs and bobbing pump jacks have altered the landscape of the region. The crude oil pumped out of the ground has changed the state's economy. All this has uprooted the way of life in western North Dakota. I'm Amy Sisk.
And I'm Todd Milby.
Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals, working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now. Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals, working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home.
You've probably heard our voices here on Prairie Public. We're reporters who cover the Bakken. I worked for the public radio collaboration Inside Energy. I spent a year and a half traveling western North Dakota, learning about oil and coal and renewables, and sharing those stories with listeners.
And I lived in Williston, North Dakota in 2012 and big parts of 2013 and 2014. I started a little thing called Black Gold Boom.
Little?
Okay, it was an obsession there for a while. I made a TV documentary for Prairie Public, two interactive documentaries, and lots and lots and lots of radio stories. And Amy, I know you were all in on the Dakota Access Pipeline controversy.
Yes, that kept me busy for months. But I used to live in the Bakken as well. I was in Ray, a small town about 40 minutes northeast of Williston. I spent the summer of 2013 there, writing about all things oil for the Tioga Tribune. And now, I'm a reporter in Pennsylvania, covering another fracking boom for natural gas in the Marcellus Shale.
I really like Ray. Glad you live there.
Me too. I loved it.
So those are our bona fides. In the next hour, we're going to revisit the Bakken and one of the big issues the drilling rigs and the influx of people created, housing.
We'll talk with two professors from the University of North Dakota about how the oil boom changed housing in the western part of the state and whether temporary workforce housing, aka man camps, trailer parks, and such, are inevitable. But before we get to those folks, and it's a great conversation, so stick around, I wanted to check in with someone I've known a long time who moved to the Bakken 4 years ago. I called up my old college roommate the other day. She's Kirstie Bogensberger. She lives in Williston, and her husband works in the oil fields. I feel like their housing situation reflects how in flux things have been ever since the oil boom took off.
Over the years we've lived in, I think, since we moved to Williston to now, we've lived in 8 different places. That sounds so crazy, but we started by living in an RV for a month, and then we lived in a hotel for 2 months, and then we lived in company housing for a year, and then we lived in a manufactured home, and then we moved back into an apartment, and then we bought a duplex. So we've moved around a lot because as we've lived here, the housing costs have gone down, allowing us to get more space for what we need.
She and her husband are landlords now. It's a side business. They hope to continue no matter whether they stay in the oil fields.
Thanks, Amy. Now we're going to turn to two people who've been studying all those different types of housing. Brett Weber and Bill Carraher are researchers at the University of North Dakota. They spent a lot of time in the Bakken the past few years, building upon the work done during North Dakota's first oil rush in the 1950s. There was a report then known as the Williston Report. You'll hear them talk about it. I'll let Brett introduce himself and his research partner.
Both Bill and I are historians. I'm a social worker, but our training is as historians. So he looks at, you know, settlements from a couple millennia ago. I'm interested more in the history of the recent past. I study the war on poverty and housing programs, so I look at housing from a social justice perspective. So we were both interested in housing, Bill from more of a material culture, and myself from a policy and social justice aspect. So we were curious about this just-in-time inventory approach that was treating workers like widgets in the machine, that they would come and go.
So what was, when you first saw Man Camp, what was your first impression?
Right. We were very excited to go out to the Bakken. We'd been hearing about the man camps, like people all over the country, all over the world. We were eventually getting contacts from Al Jazeera, New York Times, Washington Post, as our names were getting associated with man camps. But when we first went out there, we really didn't understand what we were seeing. We didn't know what a man camp was. We were seeing trailer parks, We were seeing the big crew lodges. We were seeing people living in tents out in the shelter belts and behind farmers' outbuildings and trying to figure out what is a man camp. So we eventually developed a rough typology to try to identify the different kinds of temporary worker housing.
Oh, I was just going to add that I think our first impression was that there was that perfect thing that archaeologists look for, which is enough diversity to be a phenomena that's worth exploring at length, or you know, at to some depth, but enough sort of uniformity that we could begin to do what archaeologists love to do, which is create typologies. And I think maybe the first 3 or 5 or 10 maybe trips out there were spent mostly bickering about a typology that we created as a kind of heuristic to be able to describe what we were seeing. And over the course, and I don't think the typology is ever going to carry much water beyond, you know, something that me and Brett maybe use as a kind of intellectual shorthand to talk about various.
To me, that just sounds like an intellectual shorthand for just you're trying to put different types of housing in categories. You're trying to classify it.
That's exactly what it is. Yep, exactly what it was. And it, but more than that, it became a heuristic that allowed us to kind of unpack the a lot of nuance, right? Because as the typology or the shorthand fell apart, that's really where we began to kind of explore the range of variation out there. So I remember going into our first camp that we spent a little time at. It was an RV park, I think on 85 between Williston and Watford City. And it was just trailers higgly piggly. And we were like, okay, this is something that we assumed we would see. So we're able to kind of begin to create a typology from that. But from that point on, we never were satisfied with our typology. And all we did is see more and more little variations of them.
Is the place that you're just referencing, was that right by the Tumbleweed Inn or the Tumbleweed Hotel?
No, this is actually even smaller than that. It's I think it's called the Red Wing RV Park, if I remember correctly. And I think it's near fairly close to Rawson. So it's nearer to Arnegard and Alexander, kind of between Arnegard and Alexander, if I'm remembering exactly where it is on 85, right? It wasn't even as substantial as some of those tumbleweed, some of those larger facilities that sort of accumulated there around the at that intersection. I can't remember what road it is there on 85.
When we first saw it, it was maybe 3 or 4 dozen trailers. A lot of real rough insulation wrapped around sewer pipes. People living quite rough. We were out there. It was late winter, so there was mud and ice, and it was just kind of a really sad-looking situation for people to be living in.
That description reminded me of Wheelock, North Dakota. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny town. Not even a town, really. It's east of Williston. And I'd been at the Epping Saloon in Epping, North Dakota, and met 3 Minnesotans who came to work in the boom. This was in 2012. I told them I was a reporter, and they took me to where they lived, which was this place named Wheelock.
We see a big, large houseboat sitting there for I don't know what reason, but it's huge. Blowing down buildings and several trailer houses and campers and abandoned homes and piles of trash and garbage all over. Pretty soon we'll see several stray dogs. Yeah, this is Wheelock here. This is the town. You're looking at it.
We pull up to an incredibly small camper. It's hard to believe that 3 grown men live here.
This is our land. And they call us the Sardines. There's our camper and our truck, our other truck and stuff like that.
You guys are in that little white one?
Yep, we're in that little white one. There's enough room to sleep and cook meals and play video games if we're all sitting in our own beds.
We get out of the pickup and look around.
This is our little house, man. Here, I'll come in with you.
Okay.
Chris sleeps there, I sleep there. Jeffrey, the table drops down. Jeffrey's bed's here. We got a little bathroom and shower in there. I got the generators that run outside. It's kind of crowded and messy as the weeks go on.
That was Dominic David, a young roughneck, showing me around his trailer in Wheelock back in 2012. Amy worked out west after I did. Did you ever make it to Wheelock?
Yes, I did about a year later, and it was still run down. And that begs the question, did man camps and other workforce housing change over time? Here's what Bill Carraher had to say.
You know, anyone who spent any time out there knows that you know, the kind of RV parks have begun to decline. Certainly, the kind of people living rough in shelter belts We got out there a little bit too late to sort of experience the Walmart parking lot or the public parks in Williston and Watford City being turned over. So we sort of missed that kind of bleeding edge of workforce housing, of really rough workforce housing. But every time we go out, we see fewer and fewer, say, RVs, right? And more and more, kind of traditional housing around you know, Tioga, Stanley, Ray, Watford City, and certainly Williston. So, you know, we can kind of see, and this is something actually that the 1958 Williston report sort of talks about, right? Saying that people are building more housing. But we also know that, like in the 58 Williston report, this housing doesn't always necessarily do the same thing or serve the same constituents that an RV park, for example, or a Target Logistics lodge would. And so it'll be interesting over the next, it'll be interesting over the next 5 years if we begin to see a greater influx of workers back to the Bakken, whether the Bakken has sort of solved their temporary housing problem with this kind of construction of permanent housing.
So who's to blame for the really bad housing?
I don't think anyone's to blame. I don't think it's. I think it's just a. I think it's the character of a boom bust economy. I think there's evidence in the Bronze Age of workforce housing in the Troodos Mountains on Cyprus that this has long been the way in which human society has adapted to pressures of opportunity and settlement structure.
But one of the things that we saw out there was the tension between the long-term residents and the temporary workers. And so the idea that there was someone to blame, a lot of the locals would express concern about increased crime rates and such being brought in by all the workers. The workers often felt like they were being alienated by the locals. So there was that tension going on. And part of our argument is that both of these sets of characters were being buffeted about by global forces. It wasn't people on the ground here in North Dakota, even though people thought they were agents, you know, getting to make decisions at the local level about what was going on. A lot of it was determined by global forces outside of the hands of either local policymakers or even state policymakers.
And just to add to that, this is Bill again, one of the things that we began to realize more and more is that some of the rougher housing that we thought, man, what is the circumstances that someone would want to live in a place like this? We discovered that the people living there were actually quite satisfied with it, that they were there for a very short period of time. They were saving money for their mortgage back in the Upper Peninsula or whatever the circumstances were. Now, of course, they could be lying to us. But on the other hand, I think there is a realization that the expectation that housing is good or bad is almost always, with some exceptions in the Bakken, dictated by what we understand to be traditional small town, suburban settlement standards. In other words, if we see an RV park with a bunch of insulation wrapping around RVs and kind of not super, a lot of lawn furniture outside, we may think, oh man, that really sucks. But for the guys living there, they may be saving money to pay for their kids' college tuition. This may be perfectly acceptable for them because they're a pipeline cat who's only going to be out there for 3 months. And the last thing they want is, you know, a pseudo Tudor style two-bedroom apartment that costs them a lot more money, gets them bound up in a year-long lease, and deprives them of the kind of spontaneity where if the pipelining crew isn't doing what they want, if they have a better opportunity someplace else, they can pay the rest of their month rent or not and just load up their RV and move on.
But don't you think that worker wants clean water, a toilet that works, and someplace warm to sleep?
Yeah, actually, I disagree with Bill on some of this. This is part of the ongoing argument. Were these individuals exercising their free agency on this, or were they stuck in really unsatisfactory conditions? Most of the people that I spoke with would have preferred to have been living somewhere nicer, and even more important than the quality of the housing, people generally felt that they were paying way too much. So we were sometimes talking to people you know, eight people in a two-bedroom trailer paying a couple thousand dollars a month. That was an extreme situation, but we saw enough of that. So I don't think people were, even when they were exercising their free agency about making housing choices, the menu that they were having to choose from was pretty limited.
When I arrived in the Bakken in March 2012, I was hanging around Watford City talking to people about the traffic. We were chatting about those giant big rigs that stormed through town before the state had the time or the money to build the bypass. When a guy saw my microphone and recorder, he wanted to talk.
This is Shane Osborne. I'm originally from Ohio. I was in the boom in Wyoming, out near Pinedale before all the rigs were here. That's where they were. I came out here to get a new start, and it ain't working out so good. It was actually kind of tough getting a job, you know, and it's like right now I'm out of gas. I couldn't go to work if I wanted to, you know, until I get gas in my truck, so, or get paid. I don't like the fact that I don't have a home. You know, I need a place to live. I have a camper. It's 30 miles outside of Watford City. So it's kind of rough out there. I have nowhere to store my things. My camper's full of my stuff, and the only thing I have as far as utilities go is electricity. You have to drive down the road to take a shower. I could cook at my camper, but I really don't have space to store food, so it's not real convenient. I feel like I'm falling into a depression. You know, these guys, they charge so much money for a place to live. I mean, if you pay $200 a month for a place in Missouri, and you're only making $7 an hour, you come out here and you're making 30. If your expenses are $2,000 a month for a place, I mean, you haven't really changed your situation. You just changed the percentage of income and expenses. There's no difference. It's just different figures. If the percentage is the same, you're not getting ahead.
Osborne lived in some tough conditions to save money, and that choice touches on a point Bill Carraher wanted to make in his conversation with us.
Yeah, but I would still come back to the point where and I promise I'll let this go, that there are a wide range of priorities at play, and that we tend to set a standard for housing that is grounded in part in our expectations growing up in small towns, growing up in suburbs, growing up in cities, wherever, right?
Middle-class domesticity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And these things actually also carry with them certain social expectations as well, just I could add. But some of these guys living in an RV, that the water isn't great, that the sewage isn't great, but man, they only pay $800 a month, whereas living in a better place costs them a lot more, and that they feel almost no connection necessarily to their situation that allows them a degree of kind of economic freedom. Like, not to say these are mutually exclusive situations, but especially over the last few visits out there where there is more housing available, people are still making choices not to take advantage of them. So I think there's a little more complexity at play than simply we have to provide workers mm-hmm. with better housing, which mm-hmm. I think universally we can agree with. I think what the challenge is establishing a better that both accommodates the kind of desire for people who are in the Bakken to have the kind of freedom that they want and the kind of better that you and I might expect based on our kind of more I would say normative standards of domestic expectations.
But beyond the quality of the housing, this is Brett again, I'm concerned about the sense of community that either exists or doesn't exist. And sometimes we had man camps that were larger than the host communities right next to them, and yet none of those people were paying property taxes, being elected to school boards, even voting in local political matters. So the loss of community is another aspect of this that needs to be considered.
I think you guys also describe in some of the research that I've read that within certain man camps, there really was a sense of community within those man camps. And did that help to make up for some of that lack of communication or community between the, you know, longtime North Dakota residents and the newcomers?
Well, the big crew lodges, the barrack style camps, there was no sense of community there. In fact, a worker might stay in a room for 3 weeks, go off for a week, come back and be moved into a new room. So there was no chance to personalize a domestic space there. No pictures of family to come home to, etc. The trailer parks that we went to, people got so far as to plant grass or trees, decorate their homes to personalize it in some ways. But the kind of sense of community you're talking about that we've written about was the folks who were really dependent upon one another living out in the shelter belts. That kind of sense of community did nothing to endear themselves to the local town or the people living in town. And it was pretty ephemeral, even the sense of community that they had within their camps.
You know, we tend to think of a sense of community as something that is sort of developed over, you know, long periods of familiarity, right? This is the sort of narrative of North Dakota, these small towns where everyone knows not only everyone's cousin and uncles, but you also know the next generation, their grandparents, their grandkids, right? And the sense of community tends to be this intergenerational thing, something that evolves over long periods of time, right? Like I was told by a friend of mine who lived in a small town outside of Grand Forks that you really have to live in a small town for 25 years before your neighbors will say hi to you in the morning. And I think there's certain, I don't know if there's truth to that specific story, but there's certain truth to that view of community as something that develops very slowly. What I think Brett and I witness in these man camps, because everything happens in a faster way, because the very pace of settlement creation is accelerated, that communities tended to form and dissolve at a much, much quicker way. So one of the big camps that we visited quite regularly, there were some times we'd go and everyone would talk about how great it is that this isn't a man camp here, this isn't an RV park, that this really is a community. And then you come back the next year and you're not hearing that same rhetoric, that the community has changed sufficiently that it's no longer something that they can say with a straight face. But then maybe in a year on, they're going to begin to say the same thing again. Oh yeah, I know the people in that unit and that unit and that unit. I know where they're from. And so I think this talks to the kind of, on the one hand, the dynamism, but also the precarity of living in these kind of workforce housing environments. And I think it also speaks to the kind of character of extractive industry and these boom bust economies, where you get different types of community forming at different rates in different places.
So I get that people's living conditions didn't always translate into community, but I do want to be clear. Some oil workers and their families have absolutely found a sense of community in the Bakken. Take my college roommate, Kirsty Bogensberger, who we heard from at the start of the hour. She's a mom, and she's gotten super into baby wearing. Do you know what that is, Todd?
I have no idea.
Well, it's when you use a piece of fabric to wrap your baby close to your body as you go about your day. So she leads this group of Bakken baby wearers who meet up all the time. Her sisters also moved to the oil patch, and she leads a group of moms who take their kids walking a few times a week.
It helps allow new transplants. So wives and moms that have probably been home alone for months to be finally realized, like, oh, there are people out there that want to hang out with me and want to go and do things with me and want to, you know, be my friend.
They formed a community that way, not necessarily through their living situation, but certainly through word of mouth and connecting with each other on Facebook.
Thanks, Amy. You're listening to Prairie Public. We'll be back with more in a moment on the Bakken.